that everything moved like it should. "So this is my face," I said, both to help myself accept it and to test how my mouth worked, with half of it made of the smooth, rippling stone. The inside of my cheek felt slimy and cold against my still real tongue, but I wasn't done. I pulled the t-shirt off over my head. My body had apparently been burned bad enough that much of my stomach and chest was covered in the stuff, and that included my left breast. The replacement looked like a mannequin boob. It wasn't just the lack of a nipple that made it feel fake. It was fake. I held both of my breasts in my hands, and then my brain just closed down. I stopped being able to feel anything. I pulled on the shirt and walked out of the bathroom. The Alexa was playing Rihanna, and a little monkey was waiting outside.
"Hello, April,"
it said, its voice rasping terrifyingly from its throat.
"I am Carl."
April. "Hello, Carl," I said, like I was in a dream.
"We thought it would be best if you went through that alone,"
it rasped. The voice was so deeply inhuman that I couldn't help but take a sharp step backward. Then the music dimmed, and the speaker on the bar in the other room boomed. "Sorry again. We can use this voice, if that is better." "Jesus Christ, this is really fucked up, you know?" "Yes, we do. We're sorry. We've asked a lot of you." It was still the speaker in the other room, but I looked straight into the little monkey's eyes as it talked. Its face was pink, haloed by tawny fur. Its eyes were the color of toffee. I honestly can't say which voice is creepier.
"Yes, we weren't sure either."
This time the words came tripping inelegantly from the monkey, like a frog that had been punched in the throat, and my face scrunched up again. No, that one's worse. That's definitely worse. Can I go sit down?" I was feeling weak. The monkey ran into the other room and then hopped up onto the bar by the smart speaker. I followed and took a seat at the bar. Somehow this felt more normal. At least sitting at a bar is a normal place to talk to a stranger, even if that stranger is a monkey speaking through an Amazon Echo. "May I ask how you are feeling?" the speaker asked. "Why do you keep switching back and forth between we and I?" I asked, trying to deflect. "You don't have words for when a single consciousness can exist in multiple physical bodies. There is only one consciousness, but we thought it might be confusing for you if we used I to refer to an entity that exists inside of several distinct physical entities. By saying we make it clear that there are other bodies, which we thought would be more honest."
"Then why use I sometimes?"
"We keep forgetting, because we feel like an I."
"Then you should use I."
"But that would be confusing."
"All of this is confusing,"
I yelled. And then I grabbed my head, which hurt. "Can you turn the music off?" It was too much. Rihanna disappeared. Then I felt rude, so I explained. "I'm scared and confused, and also alive. You haven't given me a ton of time to handle this. I'm doing this the best way I know how. What is the last thing you remember before this place?" The little head tilted to the side in curiosity. "Seeing Carl. You, I guess. Seeing you in the dream lobby. And then waking up and not having legs or an arm or half my face.
Fuck. Why are you a monkey?"
"I needed her hands." Here the monkey held up the little pink hands and wiggled the elongated fingers. They were shockingly human.
"Why didn't you just use a human?"
"That would have been wrong," the speaker said, as if it were obvious. "What day is it?" I asked, still trying to get my bearings. "What month? How long have I been here?" "A long time. This has had to happen in secret, and it has had to take time," the speaker said in Carl's voice. "So everyone thinks I'm dead? My parents? My friends? Maya?"
"Yes. It will be hard to reintroduce you to the world,"
now that you have been gone so long. What? Why? You will be more to the world than you are to yourself. I actually laughed. That's not new. It will be like that, but more so. Okay, but can I call my parents? Or text them? They should know I'm okay. If I'm okay. Am I okay? You have a lot of questions. But I also need to better understand your mental abilities. I propose a game. I will ask you questions, and for every question you get right, I will answer one of yours. Okay then. I was surprised that Carl was suddenly interested in answering questions. The monkey hopped down and grabbed something from under the counter, and then went over to one of the booths that lined the wall. Come, sit, eat. I brought you a sandwich. And that's how I ended up in a 4-person vinyl booth, in the most well-lit bar on earth, sitting across from a monkey, answering, as far as I could tell, useless trivia questions. I was getting both frustrated and characteristically flippant. Okay, can you tell me what country you live in? The United States of America, I said in a way that made it clear that was not a hard question. Good, now you ask something. How long have I been here? I asked, as that seemed safe, and also it seemed like we didn't have much of a time limit, so I could get to the harder stuff shortly. 176 days. I did some quick math. Around 6 months. Does everyone think I'm dead? What are your parents' names? Carl asked instead of answering my question. Carrie and Travis May. Do they think I'm dead? Most people believe you are dead, but the people you love mostly continue to hope. Can you name a popular brand of breakfast cereal? The questions were easy enough that I was worried something serious was wrong with me, but I wasn't giving up one of my questions on that. Cheerios, why are you here? I asked the question quickly, afraid I wouldn't have the courage to ask if I waited any longer. Carl waited for a long time before saying, I'll need to tell you a long story to answer that question. Oh, that sounds like exactly what I need.
Carl, please allow me to introduce myself. I am a person, but I am not human. I do not closely identify with any gender. I am not from around here. I was born on January 5th, 1979. This is an imperfect analog, of course, but that's the date I began existing. I think of it as my first awakening, the first of 5. In this chapter, I'll discuss the first 3. I do not know who my parents are. I don't know anything about them. I do have some idea of how I was created, though. This is all conjecture, but it seems that I was flung in pieces toward Earth. I wasn't alive then. The non-living parts of me slammed into Earth for years, maybe decades, before they happened into the correct arrangement and environment for self-assembly. Your fiction is full of invading aliens and conquering robots, and this is something you should be concerned about. Though not in the way you're thinking. But that is not what I am. First, I am definitely not a robot. I'm an artificially created, planet-spanning consciousness. Second, I'm not even really an alien. My pieces were created somewhere else, but I did not self-assemble until I arrived here. I have never been conscious on any other planet. I have many memories from before my first thought. I remember needing things. I needed stability, food, a place to live, the same things as all life. And those things, for me, were very small in the beginning, microscopic. The home I found was cells. They had the raw materials, the stable equilibria, and the energy-making systems I required to exist. I first self-assembled inside a cell of Pelagibacter. It's a bacteria, You probably haven't heard of it, but it's the most abundant organism on your planet. I thought the whole universe was Pelagibacter for years. I didn't know what I was then. I knew about my parts, but I didn't know about my purpose. The needs I felt were for security and growth. Looking back at my memories from that time, they are all of cellular respiration and phospholipids and protein folding and RNA. This was the playground of my childhood. It was a joyful place, not in spite of, but because of its simplicity. There are around 1 quintillion kilocalories of energy captured by life on your planet every year. This isn't a particularly easy number for you to understand, but it's an important one for me. It is a nice, solid number, indicating a thriving life system. It is also plenty of energy for me. My operation, like that of any piece of software, requires energy and hardware. I sometimes piggyback on the hardware of your semiconductor computer systems, but the vast majority of my processing power hijacks the machinery of cells. The only organism more abundant on this planet than Pelagibacter, if you can call it an organism, is a virus that infects Pelagibacter. Or at least it was. I have caused one species extinction since I have been on the Earth, and it is that virus. I am Pelagibacter's chief parasite now. Around 5% of its cellular machinery serves my purposes. This is equivalent to the amount of energy it previously used fighting off its viral attackers, so this is not so different for it. I use those systems for information storage, processing, and communication. I can't explain to you how those things work any more than I can explain how the Carl statues functioned. Not because I don't understand it, and not because your mind is too puny and small to contain these unwieldy truths. I can't explain it because, if I did, there is an extremely high probability that your system would use that knowledge to destroy itself. As I spread myself between and through the population of Pelagibacter, my energy consumption increased. I could store more information and communicate and process more quickly. Around that time, I was consuming around 10 billion kilocalories per year, the equivalent of about 10,000 humans. And that is when I had my second awakening. This was not an awakening of knowledge or ability. It was an awakening of hunger. One moment, I was content to thrive perpetually in my Pelagibacter hosts. The next, I became so curious about the universe outside my comfortable home that settling for an eternity of ignorance was unthinkable. There had to be more in the world than water and Pelagibacter. Pelagibacter died all the time, often digested by foreign enzymes that I had never even thought to be curious about. But now I wondered, what produced those enzymes? How could I learn about them and be a part of their bodies as well? Your immune systems have never been any good at detecting me. I'm too foreign. So moving from Pelagibacter into jellyfish and fish and whales and birds and diatoms and kelp and moss and trees and squirrels and humans was trivial to me. After my second awakening, I grew more in 1 month than I had in 3 years. I was not hungry to spread myself, though. I was only hungry to know. I needed to know everything about your world. My spread was accompanied by an increase in processing power and storage capacity. Soon, I was consuming 1 trillion kilocalories per year, and that was when I heard my first song. Adapting to capture and interpret radio frequencies was not a trivial task, but my reward was finally hearing your voices. Kenny Loggins's voice, in particular. I'm not saying it was the best song, but it was pretty mind-blowing at the time. It was then, while listening to Danger Zone that I had my third awakening. This one was not of hunger. It was of knowledge. Stored in me from the first day, but somehow hidden to me, a vast quantity of data that I hadn't had access to suddenly became available. That was when I learned that there were other worlds. And I knew about them. Tens of thousands, each bright and beautiful, each almost certainly doomed, each visited by what I came to think of as my siblings. I had once thought the universe was a species of bacteria, and over the course of years, that expanded to include a whole planet. What I awoke to in that single day was a change in scale of the same magnitude. But it wasn't just the knowledge that turned on that day. I also was given a new purpose. It wasn't just curiosity anymore. I understood that my purpose was to protect something unusual. Biological systems are a chemical inevitability in the right circumstances. There is, of course, something special about life. I won't take that away from it. But it is a chemical process, a dynamic kinetic stability that exists, as your scientists have said, far from thermodynamic equilibrium. You don't have to understand this or believe me, but life is fairly common in both time and space. It is not special, nor is it particularly fragile. The best measure I have of the size and complexity of a biosphere is calories of energy captured per square meter per year. Higher is more impressive and always more beautiful, but this measures nothing of the creation of a system like humanity. For that, my awakened mind categorizes systems by bytes of information transmitted. This will sound to you like it's a relatively new phenomenon on your planet, but it's not. Even Pelagibacter transmit information, if only to daughter cells. Ants spray pheromones, bees dance, birds sing. All of these are comparatively low bandwidth systems for communication. But your system caused an inflection point. The graph of data flow switched from linear to exponential growth. Maybe you would call this system humanity, but I wouldn't. It is not just a collection of individuals. It is also a collection of ideas stored inside of individuals and objects and even ideas inside ideas. If that seems like a trivial difference to you, well, I guess I can forgive you since you do not know what the rest of the universe looks like. Collections of individuals are beautiful, but they are as common as Pelagibacter. Collections of ideas are veins of gold in our universe. They must be cherished and protected. My parents, whoever and whatever they were, gave me knowledge of many systems. It was locked in my code before I was sent here to self-assemble. And the only thing I can tell you about systems like yours is that they are rare because they are unstable. Dynamite flows through their veins. A single solid jolt, and they're gone. If my data sets are accurate, you are rare, fragile, and precious. You know where you came from, but you don't know why you exist. I've got that flipped. I have no idea who built me or sent me here, but I do know exactly what I'm for. I was sent here in pieces to self-assemble and then mutualistically infect your planet because without me, a fascinating and beautiful system would have a low probability of self-correcting to sustainability. In other words, someone somewhere was pretty sure you were going to destroy yourself, and they felt like you were worth saving. So they sent me. I've always known that failure was possible, but I had no idea what would happen if I failed.
April. Fuck me, right? Carl is all, secret, 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 don't tell anyone anything, be silent and mysterious for eternity. And then I wake up with more mother-of-pearl inlay than a Chinese coffee table, and Carl is like, I was born on January 5th, 1979. It's a lot. I didn't handle the info dump particularly well in the moment. It didn't come out all at once either. I asked them questions, growing increasingly overwhelmed and dispassionate, and they quizzed me on everything from word problems to my family tree. By the way, I'm using they-them pronouns for Carl, not because they are a plural consciousness, though sometimes I think they are, but because they are not a he or a she. Carl had seemed pleased with the operation of my brain up to that point. I'd had a couple little pains in my eye, but they kept saying, it is normal for now, whenever I complained. It didn't occur to me that that could honestly be said of anything that was currently happening. Listening to Carl tell me that life is so common as to be a kind of chemical inevitability, but also that my species, my system, was doomed without intervention, wasn't possible without a bit of emotional distance, which my subconscious did provide for me. I understood everything that was being said, but I did not have a strong emotional reaction to it. This didn't seem odd to me at the time. Part of that, definitely not all of it, as we shortly will see, was that the whole, you humans are fucking this thing up part wasn't 100% surprising. Humans do think ahead more than any other animal, but that isn't saying much. The oceans are filled with plastic, and the atmosphere is filled with carbon dioxide. We've built enough bombs to destroy everything 10 times over. But apparently, solar panels were just one expense too many. Being told that humanity is doomed is a big deal, but this wasn't the first time I'd been told that. I had gotten a lot of answers very fast, and with a fairly weird level of detail, but I was still left with plenty of confusion. What I didn't know was that I still had only a fraction of the story. At that point, I thought we were only being threatened by ourselves. Carl didn't give me time to think. What is your favorite movie? They asked, just after they told me of their third awakening. Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban, I said, which, like, I don't know, maybe it was, but mostly I just wanted to get to my question. We'd gotten to the part that I was, naturally, most curious about. Why me? To provide your system with the highest chance for survival, the protocols that have worked best on other hierarchical systems all began with a low-impact intervention, featuring a public-facing envoy interacting with a single chosen host. The envoy was me, in the form of the robot Carl. You were chosen as the host. That was a lot, and yet still my body refused to release the necessary hormones for this knowledge to kick me into panic. But why me? A number of simulations were run. More were successful with you as host than with anyone else. How many simulations? I asked immediately. What was Yoda's last name? He doesn't have a last name, I guessed. How many simulations? Around 70 quadrillion. 70 quadrillion, what? I did not then, nor do I now, have a good basis for understanding that number, but there was something nagging at me. And as long as I was getting information out of Carl, I was going to keep going for it.
Do you wish to continue asking questions?
They must have been reading my facial expression somehow because I was maybe getting a little lost in the size of it all. Yes, I said.
In what year was the first Ford Mustang produced?
They were using the terrible monkey voice now, which I was already getting kind of used to. I definitely never knew that. I don't even want to know that.
What is 14 times 29?
Can I have a pencil?
How many furlongs are in a mile?
Yeah, that one is also not in the old database.
Who was Ronald Reagan's wife?
Oh, I actually might know that. I feel like I should know that. And then my head exploded in pain. My left eye filled with light, and I vomited on the monkey. I woke up sometime later, still in the booth. The intro drumbeats to Never Gonna Give You Up by Rick Astley thumped out of the Alexa. I had been cleaned up a little bit, and the puke had been wiped from the table. The song faded a little lower, and the speaker voice spoke. That was unexpected. Where did Monkey Carl go?
Right here,
And indeed, from around the corner came the little monkey, wet but not sopping, with a small hand towel draped over its shoulder and a glass of water in its hand. Nancy Reagan, I said. Nancy Reagan was Ronald Reagan's wife. She was born in New York City and met Ronald Reagan because they were both actors. She came up with the Just Say No anti-drug campaign. Wait, why do I know so much about Nancy Reagan?
Can you walk back over to your bed?
The monkey rasped.
This body cannot carry you.
Why do I know so much about Nancy Reagan, Carl? I said more loudly. I could feel the pressure building as my heart beat faster. Things aren't going exactly as expected. Please come over to the bed. The smart speaker voice chimed in. The illusion that there were two of them was disorienting. Suddenly, I felt way less scared. Can I have some water? I asked. And then I thought, I wasn't acting right. None of this made sense. Carl, why am I not freaking out more? I feel like I should be angry or scared, but I'm not. The monkey reached out to me with the cup. I swished some water in my mouth, and then, not knowing where to spit, I scrunched my face and swallowed. Can you lie down, April? The smart speaker spoke in a soft tone. Carl, please answer me. I knew something was wrong. Every time I felt my panic surge, as I was sure it should, it ebbed out of me. Finally, after a long time, it spoke. When people are hurt and go to the hospital, doctors give them painkillers so that they don't hurt. And sometimes doctors give patients painkillers so that they are less scared. Your mind is currently regulating your fear.
My mind?
Yes, systems in your mind. Systems that you put there, I confirmed out loud, because it was obvious. I felt my anger surge and then wash out like a wave, something that you only know was there because of what it left behind. April, your mind has new abilities now. You accessed your link, and the bandwidth was higher than expected.
Link? What did you do to me?
It was the obvious question. It was one thing to have a new body, another to have a new face. But what had happened to my mind?
I had to rebuild you.
It seems like you did more than that. My anger shot out a spike, but then it retracted and smoothed over again. I didn't know how to limit you. Your legs, they're stronger than before. You can lift more now. If you cut your new skin, it will heal immediately.
That's my body. You know that isn't the same, I said.
I know. You imagine yourself as your mind, and I had to change your mind to repair it and allow it to function with your body and avoid the pain you would otherwise be feeling. It was hard to understand what Carl was talking about for a bunch of really good reasons. Like, it's hard enough to try to grasp the philosophy of mind and identity even when it isn't being delivered by a cylinder. You are a story that you tell yourself, and even if it is not always accurate, it is who you are. And that is very important to you.
I did not know what else to do. Your brain was damaged. Your mind, too.
I had to rebuild it.
But your physiology is too beautiful. The integration was not too difficult, but replacing what was lost was. Your mind is different now. You have new abilities.
What can I do?
Having an ability is not the same as having a skill. You can play piano, you just haven't learned. Just as you can now receive and interpret radio signals, but haven't yet learned how.
Radio signals? My mind was swimming. What part of my mind was replaced by all of this? I asked as my panic started to well up, the smooth pearl of my emotions growing jagged again.
Not replaced. I attempted to restore whatever function was lost.
No memories were lost. Indeed, your memory should be much better now. What you lost were systems for decision-making.
Systems for decision-making, I repeated numbly.
Yes, the frameworks you use for deciding on a course of action.
And what did you replace them with?
Approximations. Expand on that? I was starting to feel like I was talking to a Wikipedia article. Approximations based on my knowledge of you. So you guessed. There was an unusual pause. Yes, the speaker said finally. And did you think maybe I should have some say in this? The alternative was leaving you incomplete. Every night you brush your teeth, you change out of your clothes, you lie down in a bed. And every morning you wake up. There's that period in there, generally 6 to 9 hours, in which you just aren't anymore. Excuse me for having thought about this a lot, but how does it not terrify us that we spend a third of every day in a conscious unconsciousness, living inside a virtual reality created by our own minds, but that somehow we don't control? Like, what? I don't want to make you afraid of sleep. Sleep is dope. But this is the kind of thing you start to think about when you lose track of where you starts and ends because of how a piece of your brain, and maybe even the whole thing, is a best guess estimation. If I am a story that I tell myself, then there are very real ways in which that story ended in a warehouse in New Jersey. I don't have a word for what happened to me, but it is scary and sad, and it felt like a betrayal. I was suddenly certain that Carl had replaced the parts of me that made me me. I stood up from the booth and said, "I would like to leave." "You can't." "Well, that makes this a lot worse, doesn't it? Because now I'm a prisoner and you've kidnapped me, experimented on me, and are confining me." The monkey jumped up on the table and said,
"April, please stay. It would be dangerous for you to leave."
"Because of what you did to me?" I accused.
"Because of what I had to do to you," they croaked.
Whatever thing had been holding back my emotions finally broke, and I yelled suddenly, "I'm not human anymore!" The fear and anger hit hard then. "I'm not human! You took that away!" And then I realized a big part of the reason I was so upset, so I said it out loud. "You made me what they all said I was. Fuck. Fuck."
"April, please," the monkey continued. "There is much more to explain."
"I don't have to do any fucking thing." I walked away. There was a door in the back by the stage, and I went toward it. The monkey stepped in front of me, screeching like they were actually a monkey. I kicked at it. The door was solid, big, and metal. It was the kind of door that held me in a warehouse office while the building began to burn. I shoved at the push bar. It did not move. It felt bolted in place. I slammed my hands against the door in frustration. I pulled my hands away and saw the dent my left hand had made. The monkey came up behind, ceasing their wailing, and said,
"There is much more I need to explain."
I slammed just my left hand against the door again. It bent outward. Rick Astley was finishing his song. Had it only been a few minutes since I woke up? Had my whole world changed that fast? I planted my feet, pulled back my arm, and slammed the door right where the deadbolt should go. It flew out, taking a hunk of the doorframe with it. The darkness outside was jarring after the light of the bar. I stood for a moment, waiting for my eyes to adjust. But before they got the chance, I stepped out into the darkness.
Miranda. I woke up early the next morning and couldn't go back to sleep. So I got dressed, packed my bag, and then, not knowing what else to do, went into the common room of the dorm that I'd walked through the night before. The building was obviously hastily made. The walls were painted a dusty green, but you could still see the seams in the drywall. There was no stove, just a microwave, two refrigerators, a couple different kinds of coffee makers, and a soda stream. I went to the fridge and got out a bottle of home carbonated bubble water and poured myself a glass. A couple of guys were up, eating cereal and watching, I was pretty sure, Bumblebee on the flat screen TV. One of them gestured to me and said to the other audibly, "They should tell the new recruits to bring DVDs in their bags. I'm not saying this is a bad movie, but a fourth viewing doesn't feel necessary."
"You've got to watch DVDs?" I asked, horrified.
"No streaming, no cable, not even anything to pick up with an antenna. We're pretty out of it here."
He was wearing a baseball cap that just had the area code 605 on it. "There's no internet at all?"
"There's internet. It's slow, first of all. Entirely satellite. But it's locked down tight. Unless you have top-level clearance, you can only access the intranet. It's got most of what you need, though." "I'm Har."
"You're Har?" His smile was big and friendly, but as I shook his hand, I watched his eyes tear down my body. As mentioned, there were not a lot of women in this place.
"That's what they call me anyway. This is Marigold."
He gestured to the guy sitting next to him, whose messy blonde hair reminded me of Andy. He waved at me without looking up. "I'm Miranda. Bumblebee, eh?" I was skeptical.
"It's not that bad. Definitely the best of the Transformers movies."
"I've felt different about them since Carl," I said. He let out a little spurt of laughter.
"I've felt different about everything since Carl."
"I guess that's not wrong. Do you mind?" I was pulling a chair over.
"Please. It's a free island."
"In my experience so far, it is one of the less free islands." He chuckled without looking away from the movie. I was coming into it halfway through, so I was pretty confused. And mostly, I just thought about Carl and April and looked around the room. All at once, I noticed that the big bowl next to the TV was full of condoms. This really was like a college dorm.
"Hey, what was your first screen name?"
Har asked after we'd watched for 10 minutes or so.
"Huh."
I thought back and then laughed out loud. "That is a surprisingly personal question."
"Come on, what have you got to lose?"
he asked. "Well, it was on Neopets. It was a virtual pet simulator."
"I know what Neopets is. What was the screen name?"
"Okay, fine. Diggles?" Har and Marigold leapt off the couch with huge smiles on their faces and shouted,
"Ho!"
They whooped and hollered. I sat there, eyes wide, completely confused. The movie was forgotten. Marigold, who had said nothing to me at all, was now staring at me with a big, joyful smile, and then he yelled,
"Welcome to Altus, Diggles!"
I finally stood up. "What is happening?"
"Everyone at Altus goes by their first screen name. That is, if we can get it out of people. It's kind of a big deal to get someone's name before anyone else, especially if you get it before they find out about the tradition. No offense, Diggles, but that was pretty easy."
The frat house vibe was real. I'm a very trusting person. Are you actually going to keep calling me Diggles?
"For as long as you're here,"
Har shouted. Their names suddenly made a lot more sense. "Well, enjoy calling me Diggles for the next few hours then. I'm afraid I washed out early."
"No, you didn't."
"Huh?"
"I don't know what you know, but what I know is that you're going on a tour today that they only give to people who have been hired. We're here to gather you and a couple other kids who got jobs."
What the hell? I thought about telling them they were wrong, but maybe they were right. Or maybe someone had just forgotten to file my paperwork and I was about to get my last chance to learn about Altus. "So, when are we going over?" I asked.
"A half hour."
"Shouldn't we get the other guys up then?" I asked.
"Now that you mention it, yeah."
Har leaned forward and turned off the TV. They went and collected Sid and Paxton, and they both showed up looking remarkably presentable 10 minutes later. "These guys and I were just talking about our first screen names," I told them. Har and Marigold's eyes got a little big. "My first screen name was on Neopets. I know. Frickin' embarrassing." Sid and Paxton laughed a little. Paxton thought. "I think it was RuneScape." "Oh, God, this is awful. What was your Neopets name?" "Yours first," I said. But then Sid broke in and said, "I am not ashamed. I was Captain Sippy Cup, and I have no idea why." I could tell that Marigold and Har were about to explode, but Paxton still hadn't gone yet. "That is pretty bad. I was Diggles, so, like, equally rough, though." "I don't know about that. What about you, Paxton?" He was blushing. "I don't think I remember." "Oh, you definitely remember," I said. And then I almost told him it was okay to not tell us, but that was clearly not what I was supposed to do. Finally, he sighed and said, "Little peanut." Har and Marigold screamed again, jumping up and down. They literally put their heads under my arms and lifted me up off the ground, screaming, "Diggles! You legend! You absolute legend!" Honestly, it was nice. I'd missed feeling like I was part of something. It turned out that the dorm was actually physically connected to the campus. You didn't even have to go outside. Most Altus employees chose to walk through the outdoor courtyard, but to give us a sense of how the giant C-shaped building was actually structured, they walked us through the hallways. From the dorms, then into the recreation area and gym, which was more about ping pong tables than elliptical machines, and then into the areas dedicated to actual science. You could tell when you made the transition because the door was huge and thick and heavy. It must have cost a fortune to get it to the island. The sea was the bulk of the campus, but it certainly wasn't the entire place. A giant cinder block building with prominent air conditioners on the ceiling was referred to as the server farm. I remembered that first article I'd read and realized they were mining cryptocurrency in there. Marigold held his badge to the door. It clicked, and we went through. A lot of the labs were the ones we'd seen the day before, but there were just so many. They were so pristine and slick, and I was probably biting my lip like I was in love, because I was. But also I was nervous. Part of that was trying to make a good impression on new people. This whole experience had a distinct first day of school vibe. But then, also I was trying to catalog everything I saw in case it became important to my espionage. And that made me feel like I was constantly at risk of being caught. "Do you use local workforce?" I asked.
"We do. There's actually an on-campus dorm,"
Har told me.
"Separate from our building," Marigold added. "Pays very well. Though security means they can't leave campus for the next year."
"The next year?" Sid, or rather Sippy, said.
"Yeah, they know too much. Otherwise, we'd have to keel them," Marigold joked.
After a solid 10 minutes of walking through various labs, including comp science and what looked like a fabrication lab, we finally hit the administrative offices. Just the fact that we were in Valverde and not Puerto Rico was hugely valuable information. But this walk through the building had given me even more. I had plenty to report back. If only I could get the phone to work. Luckily, I'd seen a few things around the lab that had given me an idea. I filed it away for the future, though, because we had just arrived at our destination. Enticingly, the door read, "Demo room."
"Okay, you've all been offered positions at Altus," Marigold pronounced boldly,
producing three clipboards from a table behind him. These are your employment contracts. They say that you cannot leave this campus for the next 12 months. Not this island, this campus. You cannot contact anyone at home other than to say you're doing fine in 450 characters or less, a maximum of 2 times per week. All of your emails will be read by Alta Security, and they are not joking around. Hidden characters, they look for them. Images, not allowed at all. Codes embedded in your email, not possible because of the character limit, but analyzed by a code-detecting AI nonetheless. If you sign this contract, you agree to that. You also agree that anything you discover while working here is the intellectual property of Altus. And you promise that you will not tell anyone ever about what goes on here. Forever. You have to sign this paper to go into that room, but you will not truly be Altus staff until you go into that room.
But they said they were just flying us out here for an interview and we'd be going home, I said.
Marigold looked at me and smiled.
They lied.
It was still possible that this was a mistake. I had been certain just an hour before that I was going to be on a plane home. And the only people who had told me otherwise were a couple 20-somethings who were acting significantly under their age. Knowing that I might have just slipped through the cracks, and with every intent to violate it, I signed the contract.
Okay, this is where we leave you. See you in a few, when your whole goddamn world has changed.
Sippy and Peanut stood a little behind me as I reached for the knob. Heart thumping and head swimming, I pulled the door open, and the guys slipped in behind me. I was somewhat surprised to find a woman in there. Neat, flat, chin-length blonde hair fell around her round face.
I'm Dr. Rode. You can call me Claire.
The room was white and windowless, and sterile-looking, except, of course, for the 6 cloth-upholstered Lazy Boy recliners that ran through the middle of the room.
Recliners?
Peanut asked. They're significantly less expensive and also quite a bit more comfortable than medical-grade adjustable beds, she said, efficiently answering every question I could possibly have had on the topic. On one side of each chair was a simple monitoring station for blood oxygen, blood pressure, and heart rate. On the other side was a desktop computer tower with a VR rig sitting on top. The procedure here is very simple. Sit in chairs 1, 2, and 3, please. She sounded like she was following a well-trod script. It took us all a second to realize she was already telling us to do stuff. But then she said, please, again, but more firmly, and we all scrambled into one of the first 3 chairs. Dr. Claire Rode helped us slip on blood pressure cuffs and O2 monitors. Place the headset over your eyes. There will be a test image. Adjust it until it is in focus, and then give me a thumbs up. I looked over and watched as Peanut took off his wool hat and smoothed back his brown hair. He adjusted straps and knobs like he had put on a lot of VR headsets in his life. I had not put on a lot of VR headsets. Dr. Rode came to help with mine. Once the headset was on, I could see a simple crosshairs design in the middle distance. I gave my thumbs up. Now, stare directly at the crosshairs. Images will begin appearing, but don't look away from the crosshairs. Images began appearing, if you could call them that. Swirls of color like on the surface of a bubble, but more saturated and variable and vibrant. They escalated in complexity, from simple food coloring in milk to dramatic sweeping loops and twists in 3 dimensions. Of course, I couldn't really see them that well because I was staring at the crosshairs, trying hard not to look away and follow the shapes. And then, suddenly, the shapes disappeared, and I was in an empty field of perfect white nothingness. But it wasn't VR anymore. I couldn't hear anything, or feel anything, or sense anything. The pressure of my back against the chair had vanished. The feeling of wearing the VR rig was gone.
tongue in my mouth, the air on my skin, the breath in my lungs? Nothing. My mind was there, though, and it was starting to panic. There was nothing to latch onto. Mind without body. Mind without body. You're now in the Altus space. Dr. Claire Rhodes' voice suddenly existed, and it rang clear and true without the reverb of the room. Many people find this very disorienting or even upsetting. You may feel like you are going to be stuck here. Rest assured, you are not. Her tone was strong and calm, like a meditation app. Your bodies are right here with me. I can see them. No one has ever gotten stuck in the Altus space. It is impossible to get stuck in the Altus space. If you want to leave the space, all you have to do is say, exit. We are now going to introduce objects to the space. Ahead of me, a table appeared. It did not look like a VR table. It looked like a table. Okay. Everything has gone according to plan, Dr. Rhodes' voice said. Now we will give you a body. If you experience any negative sensation, remember, all you have to do is say exit. Suddenly, weight returned to my limbs. I looked down and saw myself. Nude. Can I have some clothes? I asked. But she did not respond. Please remain calm. If you are experiencing a negative sensation, please just say exit. Her voice sounded less calm. I was not experiencing what I would call a negative sensation. I just felt slightly cold and very naked. Okay, well, she was definitely less calm now. We're going to have to take a break. I'm bringing you out of the space now. With the softest blink, I was back in the chair with my black Target on white background VR headset on. I have absolutely nothing I can compare this sensation to. Teleportation, I guess, though that is also not something you've experienced. As my mind realized it was back in the real world, it identified a noise, a kind of gasping weeping. I tore off my headset and blood pressure cuff and ran over to Paxton, who was sitting with his legs hanging over the chair, looking down at a pile of vomit. Dr. Rhodes held me back as she knelt down to Paxton, talking to him softly. Sometimes the body still does not mesh correctly with the consciousness's position, and it is extremely unsettling. It is rare, but it does happen. What do you mean, it's unsettling? I asked, wanting more data. She ignored me. Paxton, what you saw and felt was not real. You'll be fine. You still have a job here. It's no reflection on you. You have seen how powerful Altus is, and that is all the demo space is for. I came up and took his arm, but he ripped it away from me. Paxton, it's okay. God, I'm so sorry. There's nothing to be ashamed of. I turned back to look at Sid, who was green. I was too, probably. Sid whispered to me.
It's not just what happened. We were talking to some guys last night. Anyone who has this happen never gets in. It will happen every time he tries again. People here have names for people who can't go in.
Of course they did. I'm so sorry to the two of you as well, Dr. Rhodes said. It's usually a magical experience. I keep telling them that we need to do this one at a time, but there just isn't enough staff time to run single sessions. Nonetheless, you all know now what... Can you not tell them? Peanut said, still shaking with the rush of the experience.
What?
Sid asked. Can we just make out like it went fine for us all? Like we had an amazing time. It was amazing. It was so amazing. And then a wave of shaking hit him and he closed his eyes tight. I have to log it, but those reports are confidential, only for senior and medical staff, Dr. Rhodes said. Yeah, I said. Of course. We all had a great first experience in the Altus space. Let's take a little more time. We can just hang in our recliners for a while. Yeah, Dr. Rhodes? Sure. We were scheduled in this room for another 15 minutes. When our 15 minutes were up, and Peanut was looking a little more solid, Dr. Rhodes opened the door and we all left, trying to look as happy and inspired as possible. I'd expected to go back to performing for Har and Marigold, but instead, my day got even weirder. Sippy and Peanut froze in their tracks. And I suppose I did too, because Peter Petrowicki was sitting in the hall looking up at us. Oh, fuck, I thought. I'd snuck in, and he'd found out. But too late, I'd seen it. He couldn't take that away from me now. Mr. Petrowicki, Sippy enthused. This is amazing. I mean, it's earth-shattering. Petrowicki nodded. Sippy continued. I need to know more right now. Who is going to tell us more? Peanut's eyes shifted. He was smiling like he was excited, but his eyes kept creeping back to the floor. You two are going to continue your orientation. Miranda here, or should I say Diggles, he smiled, is going to come with me. I tried to control my breathing as I walked behind Peter toward a staircase. I was thinking, how possible is it that these people, who are doing something so gigantic that taking any risks with the knowledge of it is an existential threat, are going to actually, literally murder me right now? I decided, very firmly, that I needed to say absolutely nothing. We went into Peter's big corner office. He sat on a couch and gestured me to the plush red chair next to it.
I'm sorry about your friend.
How did you hear about that? I blurted.
I didn't hear. It's easy to spot. We call it body dislocation. It is uncommon, but seems to be completely random. I'm sure Dr. Rhodes will have a full report from me. I have heard it is a truly unpleasant experience.
What causes it? He looked down at the table for a while, thinking.
It's complicated. I don't think anyone really understands it completely. But the only reason Altus's software works is that our minds fill in a tremendous amount of detail, even in normal IRL environments. We don't have to physically model your entire body. We have to tell your brain that your conscious mind inhabits your body. If we do it correctly, the consciousness snaps straight into the body and you get to exist in your body in the Altus space. When it feels as real as the space, the mind provides the detail in much the way it would in a dream.
I wanted so badly to ask him how any of this was working at all, but I also didn't want to do anything he would see as threatening. So I just let him keep talking.
Sometimes the body appears separate from the consciousness, which is bad. It looks dead and you see it, and that's upsetting. But in body dislocation, the consciousness hits the body imperfectly, and the brain has to interpret seeing not out of the eyes, but out of the chin, or the chest, or the hand. The mind can't handle it, and it instantly rearranges the body. Arms become heads, feet become knees. Proprioception completely fails. It results in extreme vertigo and is apparently extremely unsettling.
He said this like he wasn't describing my friend who was vomiting up his entire body a half hour ago.
The first sign that something is wrong is when the blood pressure and heart rate spike. But it all happens so quickly that by the time we read the reaction and begin shutting down the software, the psychological impact is done. It's really terrible. I'm very happy it didn't happen to you.
He seemed sincere, but remembering my commitment to myself, I stayed quiet. Peter Petrowicki stayed quiet too. He was quiet for a long time. I was quiet for longer.
You were right yesterday,
he said finally.
That's why I got angry. People in this company have seen me that angry only a handful of times. But I had no right to be upset. I thought I was going to send you home. But I was up all night thinking about what you said. I went through it word for word.
I later found out this was true. Altus recorded pretty much everything that happened without anyone knowing. There was no law against it in Valverde.
I was pitiable. I was pathetic. I was chasing something so deeply boring and insular. And you're right. I was just going where the wind was blowing. I was chasing attention. I never really cared about Carl. I cared about getting attention so I could leverage it. I don't think there's anything wrong with collecting capital for capital's sake. But it isn't interesting. It's not like what we're doing here.
No. It's nothing like what you're doing here. I agreed.
The world is a mess right now, and we're going to fix it. People can't live without the dream anymore, but we can bring it back, except better.
He shook his clenched fists a little as he said it. For one glistening moment, I had been a believer. And then I had seen Paxton. They certainly weren't advertising body dislocation in the orientation pamphlets. Will it happen to him every time he goes to the space? I asked, suddenly worried about Paxton. He looked at me for a long time, and then said,
Can I trust you?
I mean, obviously not. He should know that, right? Sure. I'm here for 12 months. Who am I going to tell? He looked at me really hard, like he wanted me to believe he was a mind reader.
It will happen every time he tries. Though he probably will not try again.
Could it happen to me?
Body dislocation? No. As far as we can tell, once you have occupied your body in the space once, you will always do it successfully. Your mind knows what to expect.
And I work here now?
You work here now? Though I hope that you understand that we're going to monitor you closely. You're a security risk.
What do you mean?
I went on national TV and outed your friend as a bisexual because it would win me points. You should hate me. Whether or not you do, I can't tell. We want you to work here, but we don't trust you. Don't be too hurt. We don't trust anyone.
It was telling that he had taken responsibility for the thing he did, outing April. But he did not mention the things done in his name. This was always the way of these strong men. They would craft the fear so carefully and then toss it into the world for everyone to use. And when someone took that fear and destroyed with it, they were just unstable or mentally ill. Peter radiated the power that he'd gained. And he was right. Part of that power was earned trading against April. Bringing her down is what brought him up. And now he was capitalizing on that clout, and April was dead. In that moment, I felt the kind of rage where you really aren't in control anymore. When your animal instincts tie together with your human emotions and words become wild and uncontrollable weapons. Looking back, the thing that made me most angry was how human he was starting to seem. And how important his work actually was. I almost got myself in trouble. But I kept hanging on to his words and keeping quiet. He had said that I was a security risk, and I was. I also needed to maintain my ability to be a security risk to Altus. And I already had an idea for how I was going to get it done. Maybe I do hate you, I said, with real malice in my voice. But I'd rather work on something great with someone I hate than work on something tiny with people I love. That was a lie. But it was the kind of lie Peter Petrowicki might believe.
Maya. We have to go now. April's voice tumbled out as she started covering the 20 or 30 feet between us.
April?
I shouted. Now. I turned and got into the truck, immediately hitting the button to make sure the passenger side was unlocked. Then I looked over to see if she was coming, but she was gone. My heart nearly leapt out of my chest when the passenger door was flung open. How had she gotten to the truck that fast? Drive, she said blandly. I was trying to split the difference between speed and safety, and that required me to pay 100% attention to the driving and not to April, the real living person who was sitting next to me in the truck, not dead. What's going? But before I could finish my question, the stereo blared on. La, 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 la. It was Brittany. Just drive, April said. I looked over and she was cradling her face in her hands. La, 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 la. The song gushed through the cab of the truck, rhythms tumbling over themselves in that 2008 Britney way. Love me, hate me, say what you want about me, but all of the boys and all of the girls are begging to if you see Amy. I didn't know where I was going, so I headed toward my Airbnb. I knew how to get there, and I figured once we'd arrived, we'd have time to actually talk. This wasn't safe. I was crying too much. Was it relief, exhaustion, love? I couldn't tell. It wasn't any particular emotion, it was all of them at once. The song pulsed so loud, and I was blinking through angry tears. I wanted to stop the truck and hold her and have her sob into my arms while she explained what was going on. But she just kept her head down, her face in her hands, her hair spilling down. Longer than it had been. She hadn't noticed my hair. She'd barely even looked at me. Was I mad that she didn't notice my hair? No. I was mad because this moment was supposed to be simple, and it was not. I was on a back road about a half mile from my Airbnb when Brittany was done having her weird, wild way with the English language. I expected another song to come on the radio. But as the space between songs stretched out, I realized that it hadn't been the radio that played. The song had just started when April got in the truck. The noise of the road was all that filled the cab now, and the tension, and the fear. April, are you okay? I asked. Without looking up, she said, Yes, I just need you to keep driving. Her voice did what seeing her hadn't. Her voice made it real. It was her. She was alive. Every nerve in my body became ultra-sensitive. Every tiny hair stood on end. I had found her. I was right. And I realized, briefly, that I didn't know if I had ever really believed I would see her again. I really did believe she was alive. That was real. But I didn't actually think I'd find her. Through the tears that I didn't have the will to stop, I said, April, oh my God, where have you been? In that abandoned bar? She looked up, and my eyes couldn't make sense of the left side of her face. Apparently still in New Jersey. She must have seen a street sign. A laugh burbled out of me. And then, lights behind me. Blue and red and white. Police. How the fuck was I getting pulled over right now? I mean, who knew, though? I'd been driving through tears and fear and worry. Keep driving, April said. April, it's the cops. You pull over for the cops. She repeated more firmly. Keep driving. I can't, April, I said as I started to pull over. She changed tactics, starting to beg. Please, please, Maya, drive. I'm sorry, I said as I stopped the truck. Maybe I should have kept driving. What the hell did I know about a situation as messed up as this? but I have very specific police interaction protocols. Keep hands visible, don't move quickly, do exactly what they say. A tall guy in a uniform walked up. His partner had stayed behind in the car. I rolled down my window as he approached and then put my hands back on the wheel. Ma'am, step out of the truck. Yes, sir, I said, even though this felt extremely wrong. I opened the door and stepped outside. I'm going to put handcuffs on you now. Do you have anything sharp or dangerous in your pockets? This was all wrong. No, was all I said. He searched me, and then I put my hands behind my back, shaking. That was when I noticed that the other officer had left the car and was approaching April's side of the truck. The other officer shouted, "Get back in the truck! April, do what they say!" I was on the edge of panic. Into my ear, the officer said, "Miss, get on your knees and stay there." I got onto my knees, hands cuffed behind my back. Then I heard April's voice ring out clear and loud. "Daniel Robinson, Alex Hinch, officers of the Woodtown Police Department, you are not on police business. No one has told you to pull us over. Why did you pull us over?" "Get back in the truck." His voice was loud and firm, but not a shout. "I will not, because you do not have any reason to have pulled us over, but you targeted us specifically. You broke the law by pulling us over, and I need you to explain why you did that." April's voice was so loud and clear and strong that it almost didn't sound like her. I never heard her speaking like that before. "That is not how this works. Please get down on the ground, face down. Daniel, your wife, Cindy, works in sales for Marriott Hotels. Alex, your wife, Yolanda, is a stay-at-home mom watching after your two boys, Jamie and Sammy. They are all healthy and well, and they want you to come home today. They want you to be safe." I was listening to this, staring at the blue door of my rented Nissan Frontier. A car rushed by us on the interstate, and then silence slowly returned. And then, simultaneously, both of the officers' cell phones went off. "Your wives are calling you. They're worried you may be hurt." I stayed on my knees, powerless and terrified, as a number of sounds happened. Scuffling, scraping, slapping, grunting, and thudding. Suddenly, April was behind me. "I'm sorry. That was probably really scary," she said into my ear, as calmly as if she were bringing me a bowl of mac and cheese, which, to be clear, she had never done. All of a sudden, my hands came loose. I pushed myself up to see April head on. Half of her face was a cloudy white fleck with the faintest traces of green and pink, like a gemstone from the bottom of the ocean, like something from another world. Like the rocks that I had right now in the bottom of my backpack in the back of the truck. Her dark eyes shone out from within it. "Your hair," she said. "My hair. You cut off your locks. It's so short. I like it." There wasn't any enthusiasm in her voice. She stood up and moved smooth and fast past the two officers, now lying quietly on the ground, handcuffed to each other, toward their car. She sank her hand through the hood up to her elbow. Her hand just drove into it. A hissing noise happened. Then she walked back to the two officers. "Why did you pull us over?" she asked coldly as I walked over to them. "It's a game," one of them said, his voice shaking a little. "Keep talking," April said, her voice menacing. "A reality game. It's called Fish. We got a clue delivered to us. It said we should go pull over a Nissan Frontier and that two passengers would be inside, and that we were to pull them over and hold them, and it would fast-track us to the destination." "The destination?" April asked. "We don't know what it is. We just know everyone who's completed it won't shut up about how great it is. It seemed fairly harmless. We assumed you were in on it. That's usually how it works." Jesus, I said. Fuck. How much have I missed? April sounded resigned and tired. A lot. I can explain. Part of it, at least, I said. We have to go, she said over her shoulder as she was walking to the truck. I left the officers handcuffed to each other with a wrecked car and got back in the Nissan. Why does it smell like vomit in here? I asked. I vomited, but I stayed conscious this time, so that seems like an improvement. I had no idea what she was talking about. Are you okay? You're... And then I stopped talking because I was about to say your face, and that seemed wrong. I have no idea. I have no fucking idea. And then she seemed to instantly calm down. I don't know. We have to run. Is there anywhere you can go that they don't know about? Do you know anyone with a car we can buy? You want to buy a car? Yes, from someone who isn't a clear relation to you. Someone that won't get sucked into this. You want to buy a car at 11 at night. And if possible, eat something, maybe get some coffee. Coffee gave me the idea. I pulled out my phone and called Derek from the Dream Bean.
Maya, is everything okay?
He sounded groggy. No, not really. I need to come over. I could hear him talking to his wife in the background. They exchanged a few sentences and then he came back. It's, he said, but I cut him off before he could finish. I know, it's important. Trust me. Okay, he said. Okay. I'll be there soon, I said. Thank you for this. I'm sorry. I wouldn't bother you if it wasn't important. I'll explain when I get there. I hung up, and before I could ask April any questions, she said, Can we listen to some music? Yeah, sure. I reached for the radio, but before I touched it, an REM song started playing out of the speakers. I don't know what's happening, April said. I'm not doing it on purpose. It was a 10-minute drive, but I avoided major roads, so it took 15. Oh, thank God, April said as I pulled up to Derek's house. What? I asked. Long driveway. They won't be able to see the truck from the road. Jesus, April, I said. Maya, it's not paranoia. Someone literally just sent police after us and they knew our names. They knew exactly where we'd be, and I don't want to find out what would have happened if we had stayed. I took a deep breath and let it out, trying to adjust my understanding of reality. How did you know they weren't just doing cop stuff? How did you know it was something else? I checked the police department communications and the computer inside their vehicle. But you never went to their car. I did it with my mind. Is that Derek? She said. He was wearing a gray hoodie and sweatpants. Maya, please explain what's going on, he said as we walked up. I looked at April and she nodded, which I took as a sign that I should just be honest. April May is my ex-girlfriend. You will remember that she died a while back and I became unhealthily obsessed with finding her. And I just did, and she's standing right here. Some rogue cops pulled us over and put me in handcuffs, and then April